To those of you that attend regularly, I see several familiar names, and welcome if this is your first session. I'm Gina Kozak. I'm your host and coordinator for ODXT, Organization Designed by Technology, and this is one of the many ways that you can engage with the ODF community. Our guests today are Dean Walsh and Jeremy White from OrgSure. Some of you were with us in Pittsburgh and possibly heard Dean and I partner to make the case that design can achieve higher precision when we bring analytical rigor to the design choices, backed up by testing and monitoring. So today, what Dean's going to do is go deeper into that first step, data analysis to inform design. As I'm sure you're all experiencing, most organizations are facing the same challenge: how to redesign work as augmentation and agents advance. And the uncomfortable truth is that many of these efforts are not realizing the planned return. So Dean's going to take us through a real value stream to show how you can realize better returns by analyzing work at the activity level. That enables separating execution cleanly from coordination work, which is harder to quantify and to discern where ROI actually comes from. Just a couple logistics. There are 2 points planned for questions, one after the concept is outlined, and then another after the approach is demonstrated. And I'll also watch the chat. So please feel free to drop questions in there as well, and we'll collate those. A reminder, ODXT sessions are about exposure. So if you'd like a full demo and pricing, you will have Dean and Jeremy's contact information. And also, this session is being recorded, and it'll be sent to everyone who signed up along with a copy of the content. And I think with that, if there aren't any questions, we're ready to get started.
Great. Well, thanks everybody. Some of the faces and names do look familiar from the ODF conference a couple months ago in Pittsburgh. As Gina mentioned, we'll start by talking about activities as data and a little bit of background. We can tie some of this into decades-old academic research, not that we'll spend much time there. I have a PhD in this stuff, and so I sometimes get sidetracked on that, but that won't happen today. And then we'll go through an actual case. And through the whole thing, I'll stress the importance or the benefit of using activity data and even make the argument that organizations should do a better job of maintaining this data as an information asset, very similar to other things that exist. So let me go ahead and my colleague is here too. You can see, you may be able to see Jeremy, he's waving right now, but I'm going to be on presentation mode. So I'm not going to see anybody. So Gina or Jeremy, if there's a question that comes up, we do have planned breaks. I tested this presentation over the last couple of days. It should not run long. My tendency is to speak fast. So if anybody needs clarification on something, somebody just let me know and I'll be happy to do that. So let me share my screen.
I'm also going to interrupt just for 1 second. I know Dean very well. He's got a PhD in the subject. So if you feel like you're just not kind of grabbing what he's trying to get, or if his point's not landing, please feel free to ask for some clarification.
Okay, can you everyone see my screen okay? And I'll need a verbal that you can.
We can.
Yep, we can.
Okay, great. Okay, perfect. Here we go. All right, so some of you may remember this or parts of this from the ODF conference.
And Dean,
The
there's some kind
argument.
of box up on the screen. It says continue to share or something. Is that just on your screen?
I don't see it at all.
Does anyone else?
I
There's something right in the center of the screen.
do. It
Yeah.
says continue to share this keynote window
Yeah.
question mark.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
It might
There's a
be my
window right
equipment
over
window.
our view. Maybe just try the whole thing again.
Or just hit play.
Yeah. I hit play. That's exactly what got us here. So let me try it again and see if you see it.
Yes,
So I see
still
that.
doing
I
it.
want to
Yeah.
be
I
displaying
right
on it.
there. Right there. Is it okay now?
It's
No, we
still
still
there.
see a little box and it's grayed out.
Okay, let me do this. Let
Your
me,
mouth was right on the click button, though, when you did that.
do this. I can make this smaller. It seems to be popping up on everybody's screen, but mine in presentation mode.
Yeah,
So,
Matthew
am I?
thinks it's on a different monitor, but that looks okay. I think what you're showing us, and it's a
Okay.
very lot of white space, so I think this will be fine.
Yeah,
Let's keep
this
going.
works. Okay, good. All right. So This model that you see here, it was just the steps that we advocated during the ODF conference in Pittsburgh. And really, what we were doing is treating our case almost like a science project where we proposed hypotheses and we would go through testing and all of that. So today's presentation, we're going to spend more time on this first step, the work analysis. And the way that we're, or the method that we're going to use here is activity data. And we'll certainly talk about that the entire time. There were a couple of papers mentioned at the ODF conference, and this one right here, which was an MIT study that came out last year, that mentioned that 95% of AI pilots failed to show a measurable return on the P&L. And then they offer these reasons that you see here. Now, obviously, you've got to take that with a grain of salt because they were pilot projects. But the theme that technology doesn't deliver these lofty returns, project after project, whether they're AI or not, is very common. And so I think this is a really good starting point. And of these six reasons why these projects fail to show a return, we're going to focus on the last one. And obviously, you can see that just by the color that it's highlighted. But I think there's two reasons for that. The first is that the five other reasons you see here are really kind of common. If you've worked in organizations, particularly large organizations, for any length of time, you've seen these before. It's very rare when someone, if you've ever experienced it at all, that someone would say, "Oh, our coordination work has been ignored." So I think this is a good opportunity to kind of dig deeper into what that means. And secondly, it makes a really good connection to org design itself. You know, everyone, and if you work in large organizations, right, it's a lot of people like working at the lines and boxes level. And many times the power of your design is reflected at what happens at the job level, at the job design level, the work that gets done. And this kind of forces us into that. And I'm not saying that happens all the time, but I've witnessed it enough where we don't go into enough detail. And so this coordination work, or kind of exploring the idea of coordination work, helps us do that. So first, I think we should define what that is. And I will say, by the way, that the ideas here, execution and coordination work, go back almost 7 decades. You know, if you look at the work of Herbert Simon or Henry Mintzberg, Emory and Trist, sociotechnical systems, they indicate or they get at ideas just like this. And I think the best way to define or to talk about coordination work is to discuss its counterpart first. So execution work is that work that's explicit. If you think about, you know, transactional stuff, which many execution activities are, they're highly visible, right? They A follows B, or A leads to B, B leads to C, et cetera. It's the kind of work that lends itself very well to technology because rules can be encoded in the technology and pretty much just duplicate what the human does. Coordination work is a bit different. It's frequently judgment-based. It's integrative. It's boundary spanning. Think about if a process or a transaction is execution work, coordination work could be the work that surrounds that and enables it to happen. So, for example, it might be problem solving or escalations that take place. It's making sure that transactional outputs get delivered or made aware or visible in other parts of the organization. It's a little harder to automate that. Now, the idea is, and what we've learned with some of the AI projects and the news that we read, is that AI is moving into this space, right, where maybe judgment can be automated. But the interesting thing about coordination work is that many times it's what allows the ROI to be reached. It's responsible for this compounding effect, right? I've got a number of benefits that show up from the technology at the position level. How do I make sure that these things happen en masse? And that's the coordination work. And that's what happens. That's how the ROI is reached. And so the problem, if we could restate that problem from the previous slide, where the AI projects or the technology projects, if you want to be a little more broad about it, they focus at the execution level of work, but pretty much ignore the coordination components. Or to state that differently, the entire work landscape is not being considered, only part of it is. And so if you were, not knowing anything about organization design or this type of work, but I said, oh, we're going to bring an improvement to part of the organization's work, naturally, I think you would think that the benefits are not going to be as great as they could be. So this graphic right here really sums up my biggest soapbox. And I, to be honest, I have many soapboxes. But right here, what I'm trying to convey is that activities are the ideal unit of analysis when we study organizations. Now, that's not to say that every type of analysis we do relies on activity data, but there's a fundamental compounding effect when you use it to define work. And that's what we do. In fact, that's if you ask somebody, what is the work of the organization? They'll start describing, oh, this is what we do. And if you get it down to its base level, it usually comes down to activities. And so we build on that idea where you say, okay, I can define work as activities. I can then say those activities get bundled into positions and jobs, and those jobs get arranged into structures. And by using activities as my unit of analysis, I have much easier abilities or analyses that I can use across levels. It makes all types of analyses much more viable. And we harped on this at the conference too, and I'm probably not the first person in your professional life that's talked about this, but I feel so strongly about this that we built a company around it. So when you get these activities, and many of you, I can't see a show of hands, obviously, but I suspect many of you have worked on projects where the first thing you had to do was build an activity list. And that can take months and months to do properly, to get everyone to agree on what activities we're trying to assess, if find out if everybody interprets them the same way. What you end up building is a list. And as the project progresses, you reach a point where you've got an idea what that solution looks like. And what tends to happen is we stop using the activity data. Not that it gets deleted, but it sits in a file on a server someplace and it rarely is looked at again because now the project is going down a path that they feel good about. If you compare that to a taxonomy is built to connect data by definition, right? And so you can connect different types of attribute data, for example, so that the types of analyses you get using a taxonomy compared to a list is typically different. Now, that's not to say your list couldn't be just as descriptive, but what really makes the distinction between the two is how you can validate that. A taxonomy lends itself to system-wide validation much more cleanly. And the reason that's important is if you're going to be doing a lot of analysis using activity data, you want your data to be correct. I won't spend much time on this. This is the point that I was trying to make earlier, or I mentioned that organizations spend a lot of time, and it's usually a single point in time to get activity data in a format that can be used in a project, and then it's generally disregarded. I would argue that that data should form the basis of an organization-wide set of data that should be treated as an asset. It's incredibly important. If you think about what you've done, you've defined what the organization does in a way that you can now measure. Instead of just saying work happens, you can say specifically what happens and you can attach effort and cost to that. To me, it's a really rich data set. In fact, we've spent the last couple of years coming up with a taxonomy that we think is universal. But what I want to show you is that what you see in the circle there is that's the type of reporting that you can get very easily if you build an information system around that, rather than just building a list and doing away with it after you've used it one time. Are there any questions on that, on activity data, how you manage it or anything like that? Again, I
Yes,
can't see, so.
I think the concept of activities as an asset is probably fairly new. So, can you talk about what that might look like in practice? I mean, I think everybody's aware of all kinds of different data stored, but how would one keep up with like activity work? And then probably everybody's been on projects where you had activity data and then it's in some
Right,
spreadsheet
right.
and it goes away, like you said. So, can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I think that's a good question because I mentioned this previously at the conference, but I'll say it again. I think the lack of systems to track activity data probably represents the biggest hole in enterprise information systems that exist. We have, think about ERPs and HRIS and all these different tools that we have. They're all designed to track certain data, and many of it fits into a taxonomy. Much of that data fits into a taxonomy. But when people think work, they naturally think, oh, we've got it covered because we have the latest and greatest HR system. Let's say it's Workday, or we just put all of HR under SAP. They think that because people do work, and this is the logic train here. People do work. HR manages people, ergo HR must be able to manage work data as well. And that isn't necessarily the case. The reason we don't do this is because that initial work to get the taxonomy, to get those activities built, is really hard. But once you get it, you don't want to throw it away. The problem is you don't have a good place to put it. There
And
aren't
we have another
systems.
good question around. Oh,
Okay.
sorry. I thought you were done. Go
Oh,
ahead.
no, but you don't have
Okay.
systems to track it. But if there's no reason you couldn't have a system of, and you'll see screenshots of our stuff, but it's not the only way to do it. But there should be systems and organizations that track this work. It's incredibly important. It gives you insight into cost and effort and value that you don't have otherwise. What was the other question?
The other question was about kind of maintaining it, like it was when it's in not just maintaining it, but in transformation when activities are changing.
Sure.
What's the logic around that, and how do you go change it? You want to be doing something else, I think, in other words, is the way
Correct.
to
You
interpret
want to,
that question.
there's actually two cases there, right? What happens when work changes, right? How do you get that data? We rely on surveys. And if you build your surveys right, it is a very low effort means of getting data. But there are parts of the organization that change more frequently. So use AI and IT as an example. You might want to have people that work in those domains surveyed more frequently to show what they do. But the other piece of change is, what if there's something new about our strategy? We have to engage in something that we've never performed before. You can actually define those activities, what that future state work like, and build it into current jobs. So when you look at your data, say, okay, we've got this activity. We just don't have any effort to it. We're not doing anything with it. It actually gives you a way to manage and plan for that future need better than just saying, oh, we've got to hire somebody in X. But again, you can't do that unless you've got a system that tracks it and manages it.
And when you say system, what kind of thing would people do? I mean, can you augment Workday? Do you Excel, or do you, I mean, what are kind of some
Well,
of the
so
things? I mean, obviously
everybody,
we're talking about OrgSure here, but
correct.
we want to enable people to think through the method.
Correct. So think of it this way. You could, every organization I've been in, there are one or more Excel wizards, right? They've got a background in access and database, and they can do amazing things with spreadsheets. Even with people like that, managing this in spreadsheet really is a manual activity, and it gets tedious. And then it gets really hard to add other data. Most HR systems are not designed to track this kind of stuff. Yes, you could have a database built, and pick whatever flavor your organization uses. It's the integration that makes it really hard. But yes, you should, my argument is that yes, you should track it. There should be more systems that allow for this to happen right out of the box. And that's kind of where we are in our startup. This is exactly what we've done.
Hey Dean, I think the two questions we have are kind of related. So what do we do when activities are changing? And it seems like there's a clarification on what activities are. So maybe we can quickly go over like a fractured job or something like that
Yeah,
to,
well, we're
or if you've
actually going
got
to
a
show examples of that. So that's good. And whoever asked that question, or if multiple people did, keep that in mind. So how you frame an activity, think about a continuum, right? So from very granular, I'm going to define work by a set of tasks, right? And that database has thousands and thousands of things. And I do this keystroke and that keystroke. It's not very usable. It'd be very descriptive, but it's not usable. At the very other extreme, at the end of the spectrum, I do finance. That's okay. It gives me an idea of what I do, but within finance, I have no idea. So somewhere in between there is a way to define an activity so that it remains unique in this big taxonomy that you have and is descriptive enough to provide meaning. And we can't get into everything that goes into taxonomy building, but you'll see some examples as we go forward.
Let me close these two questions, and I think Linda came off mute, which is okay. So activities similar to tracking billable hours, in that you can assign value and cost. So the concept is the same, that you could assign some value to it.
Correct.
And then the other one is around work not being created equal. Exactly. That's the beauty of the activity analysis, is that you're able to
Sure.
stratify it so that you can determine what is strategic enabling or not. And what Dean's about to take us through is how to take apart the activities to be able to do that at a more granular level. And then Linda, I think I saw you come off mute. And if you were going to speak, that's great. If not, then we can move on.
And someone, whoever raised it, it's a really good point. We assume because someone's got a job title, or Gina and I have the jo same job title, we do the same thing. But when you look at the activity level, even positions within the same job, there can be a great deal of variability within the activities they perform. Now, most of them should be the same. That's why they're under the same job title. But you would expect some variability in there too. And being able to measure that and see those differences, it becomes really powerful. We'll show some examples because being able
That
to
was it.
look at jobs like that, I think, is really important. So what you see, this is just some background information on our hypothetical organization, Industrial Products. They're mid-market. They do both manufacturing and services and have e-commerce capabilities. So generally, with multiple locations in the mid-market, you've probably seen this, they have operational units and functional units that are also distributed. All this is just saying they have a relatively complex structure, right? And so what they want to do, the hypothesis that we're going to follow is that if they automate a particular value stream, this one is order to cash, it has certain benefits to the organization. And so we want to be able to kind of test that. So it's a company of about 2,100 employees, a little over $1 billion in revenue. And you can see some of the other data. The important ones are underlined in red. They relate to the project because those will be what we compare against when we think about ROI, and primarily that $1.8 million in year one. Now, that might not be, or that a project of that size might not move the needle when you're talking about Unilever or General Motors. I mean, people would still be upset if it failed, obviously. But in a mid-market, both the success and the failure captures a lot of eyes. There's a lot of attention. It's a meaningful project. So what is a value stream? I don't know if anybody has worked with value streams. They're becoming more popular. They're actually becoming standardized, a lot like functions are. So in our system, we track, I think, 11 or 12. They tend to be the ones that you see most often. And a value stream is a sequence or a series of activities that produce value. That's not very descriptive. Think of it like a process, right? You've got this series of work where A ends up producing Z or something. But what makes a value stream different is it's based on the value that is described by a client. And that client can be both internal and external. And value isn't necessarily a dollar value, although it typically equates to that, or an amount of revenue. It's what that client needs. So think of order to cash. It is both a process and a value stream. A lot of modern finance organizations have units that are called order to cash. It just happens to be the tail end of the order to cash value stream. So order to cash starts as a value stream. It starts after an order was created, right? So sales creates the order. It is those sets of activities that happen after that that leads to a payment being collected by the organization, usually done in cash applications or something like that. But there's a lot of work here. If you think about in large organizations with complex orders, the first thing that happens after an order has been booked is order validation. People want to make sure that the terms of the order match either the customer's credit allowance or the terms any type of agreement. There's fulfillment, delivery planning, delivery, problem resolution, you name it. Billing and invoicing, right? And then finally something hits cash apps and that stops that. But if you don't look at this work in detail, if someone were to say, okay, we've got to understand the value stream called order to cash, your first instinct might go to finance. All right, finance tells you about order to cash, and they only tell you about their piece of it. You don't recognize that this value stream starts right after the order was made. So it includes, the sales, fulfillment, customer service, which could be in shared services or something like that, and then flows all the way through to finance. So one of the first things you have to do is understand the work of OTC. There's a little screenshot here. This is in a system like ours, it's easy. I can filter and find the data. But why do we have to do this? We want to get the scope of this project, right? Some executives got together and they think, yep, there's benefit if we improve our order to cash our value stream. Great. You don't know anything about order to cash or that the company even tracked it, but clearly someone did. And now we've got to try to figure out what happens if we try to automate that. So we've got to understand the scope of our work. Given that, and this ties back to the point that someone made that not every job is the same, even though they have the same title.
Dean, sorry to
Yes.
interrupt you there. I got a couple people saying that your voice is a little soft and a little harder to follow. Can you get just a little closer to the mic? Because everyone else is
Yeah.
of the same volume. Perfect. That will do it. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt, but didn't want to
No,
go
that's
on a
okay.
complex topic when we couldn't
Does this
completely
sound
hear you.
better? Oh yeah,
I
way
think it's
better. Does
much
this sound
better.
better?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Sorry about
Okay. No problem. So trying to understand what that scope is, we've got to look at jobs. We've got to look at positions. What pieces of our organization are actually doing this work? Well, if I don't have a system to do this, I can look at job titles and start talking to managers of particular jobs and figure out what happens. And I could come up with a population that is pretty close to what the O2C value stream looks like. We're going with the assumption that we have our tool or something like it, and here's what we find. There are 34 jobs in the organization that contribute to the value stream O2C. 95 positions across those 34 jobs. But notice that we've got an FTE measure of 99.1. How do we have an FTE count differ than positions? Is everybody familiar with that? If I'm an executive and I work 60 hours a week on average, I've got an FTE multiplier really of 1.5. The amount of effort I put into my activities, our system actually changes based on your FTE multiplier. Doesn't affect pay, but when we want to understand activities, understanding the total effort is really important. The pay for all of these positions comes out to be just over $7 million a year, right? So if we can bring some type of benefit to that, it could be substantial. And then the last two numbers are just showing the tenure, organization tenure and position tenure. But that doesn't tell us everything we need to know, right? Now we've got to understand the context of these jobs. So I'm only going to look at a couple of these. This is just for your own edification. You can see the types of measures that our system generates. But the first one, excuse me, this idea of rating N, it's just a normalized measure. Any organization should have performance data, and you can look at performance data for this population for OTC. So, for example, maybe this is why managers think that we need to bring in automation. Maybe there's this sustained low performance here. Maybe it's the way the work is defined, whatever it may be. It's surfacing here, so maybe that's a clue. The other one down here called redesign. A lot of organizations have these jobs that can't be touched, and they don't surface until the project is way down the road. And all this is saying is, how many of these positions that we're talking about are eligible to be changed if we need to? Are they locked down by a union contract, for example? Or do we have maybe some contractors that have so much expertise? We brought them in and they define the job as they're going to do it, and we can't really change that. Knowing which positions can be changed and which can't kind of shapes what we can do down the road. So knowing that's important. And then how efficient is what we do right now, right? This kind of points to should we apply technology? Now, in our world, this efficiency gap is relative. So for example, let's say you did just put in SAP and your transactions are running as designed, right? And you think that's about as efficient as they can get. And then you learn some of these wonders of AI, right? Oh, wow, this could even be that much better if we applied AI. And then someone might determine then that these activities that are run on SAP could be much better. And you would say, yeah, I think we've got a high gap here. That doesn't change the priority of what the company's going to do, but collectively, these things might say, okay, this is a good candidate for automation. So now we have to get down to activities, though. So, right, we've kind of figured out what the population is. We have to understand the work. And so, in order to do this, we've got to get to the activity level. And if you don't have activities, this part becomes incredibly hard because I've got to then try some way to figure out what percentage of a job is OTC or non-OTC, and which parts of these jobs are execution versus coordination. Being able to break these jobs down into their activity components becomes very, very valuable. Again, this is just a screenshot. You can kind of see how we structure data and some of the stuff that goes along with it. But let me just tell you what we find in our sample case here. We have 19 activities that contribute or that define what OTC is. And if I look at the pay for each of those activities, and our system can calculate this down to one FTE, we know what an FTE of every activity costs. We can look at the total FTE and say, okay, this costs the organization almost $5.9 million a year. But that's different than the $5.09 million that the jobs cost. What explains that? This was brought up earlier. We're probably performing activities in those jobs, in those positions that do not contribute to OTC. It's work, it has to be done nonetheless. And in fact, that's what we find. In our sample data set, we have 32 activities that get performed by these 95 roles that aren't tied to OTC. So think of it this way. In the positions, there's a lot of activity blending. I might do a little bit of supply chain work. I might even do some low-level finance work or something else. That's really, really hard to flesh out if I don't use activity data. I think the best you can do then through interviews or other, maybe some proxy data is to figure out the percentage of a position that does OTC versus non-OTC. So this really gets to being able to disaggregate these jobs and figure out what they do in a very specific way. But that doesn't finish it. So think back to the beginning of the presentation where we talked about execution activities and coordination activities. We have to take our activities and put them into classes or groups. And we have to do that for very specific reasons. And I'll tell you how we can do it. Execution activities, that represents the sum total of the work we want to automate. It's 12 activities we found in our data set, but 63.4 FTE. If I look at nothing else, I know that's a potentially large impact. Generally, you equate an FTE with a position, right? So I know that's enormous. Coordination activities, we don't want to remove anything here, but we want to make it more impactful. We want our coordination to be really tight so that if we go down this path of automation and we believe the MIT study, right, that coordination makes the difference on that. We want to maximize our ROI, and so we have to do something with our coordination activities. Maybe blend them all into single positions so they're really dedicated. And thirdly, we cannot forget about the OTC activities. There have been plenty of projects that I'm aware of, and everybody on this call is probably in the same boat, that when you start moving these activities around, in effect, you're breaking jobs, right? I'm going to take 63 FTE out of this work population. Somewhere I've now broken a lot of jobs. This non-OTC work is work that gets performed. Who's going to do it? We have to account for that. And so that's why we have to break the activities into these classes. Now, what if you don't have a system like Workshore? What can you do? We don't have a huge number of activities here. So you can actually go look if you've got activity definitions. Let's say you've got the data, but you don't have the system. You can look at the activity definitions and understand their intent, or try to understand their intent, and put them into categories, into classes. And that gives you an idea. Now, just understand, since you can't get down below the job level, or you can't know for certain what these things mean, there's going to be a little bit more error, but you can do it manually. But what would you do if you had 40 activities and say 2,000 FTE? That becomes really hard manually. Any questions on that? Now, really, what that last section focused on was how do you break jobs down into their activity components? I think it's pretty clear. If there are any questions, we'll keep going. But if there are questions, I'm happy to answer them right now.
I think there's general interest. We've got one on how activity pay is determined, time spent, or proportionate value. So I think there's a lot of, if we can go a little bit more into just value and cost and how we assign that, I think they might find that helpful.
Oh, I think that's good. Yes. So if you're collecting activity data, so I'm in a job, and if you've got the activity data and you know how much time is spent on that at the position level, right? And I know the loaded pay for every position, right? So I'm pulling data in from HR at this point. So for example, if I'm in a position that's $100,000 loaded pay, and I have two activities, activity A and activity B, and I do them equally. 50% of my time is A and 50% of my time is B. I can take, for my particular job, I can say half of my loaded pay, $50,000, gets attributed to A and $50,000 gets attributed to B. If you have a system that does this, I look at every instance of every position where that activity or those two activities are used. And I can come up with not only the sum, what the total cost of that activity is, I can figure out the average per FTE. So let's say I've got an FTE. Remember we talked about multipliers? FTE of one. I work basically 40 hours a week and my time splits up that way. But when you have that granularity of data, I can then look at it and say, oh, okay, this activity cost the organization per FTE this much, and here's what it costs in the aggregate. I can even show you, I don't know if I have it in this screenshot. You can see here, we can figure out activity pay by job, by position, and by FTE. It's actually a pretty easy calculation if you have the base data. And the base data is how much time is spent on that activity, what the pay is per the roles that perform that activity, and then being able to aggregate it. I hope that helps. Did that clarify? For anybody that can see a head shaking, did that work?
Or put anything else in the chat if you'd like, if you can't come off mute for whatever reason.
Yeah, the example that sits in my head, because I don't have 30 years in organizational design, is I think about software departments. Engineers tend to have their time protected by all departments because it's very expensive to house engineers. They're a huge cost center. If you have an engineer who's doing invoicing or accounting or support activities, they're going to show up as an outlier when you look at that data. All of a sudden, why is this one activity costing us, $50,000 in payroll when every other person is doing that for $20,000? Because you basically have somebody with a higher salary. And when they give us their survey data and they tell us how much of their time they spend working on that activity, and say 20%, we can look at it and say, wow, why is this person who's really expensive spending 20%, resetting passwords? That's the kind of stuff we want to see bubble up by showing the percentage-based FTE stuff.
And if you do that well, you can then figure out the cost and the effort for each of those activities. And then the math becomes simple. Does that help?
There was a
Thank you.
question from Linda about what if the activities change? How do you calculate that? The idea would be you want to regularly get these activities. You want to see them change. You want to see how they shift, however often you can get that data put in your system. And then you'd want to recalculate so you can keep a snapshot over time of what your business is. So instead of doing a consulting project every 3 years where, things change over 3 years, do it more often, keep track of it as you go, and let the calculations rebuild so that you can see how things are tracking.
Yeah, and let me add on something there. I think I mentioned something this. People are really good at re recalling and reporting trends. So when someone says, oh, I do these four or five or even three activities at these percentages, that tends to be very, very accurate. If I ask you, what did you do four Thursdays ago, you have no idea. But if I ask you what you do on your average work week, you do that really well. What tends to happen over time, let's say your activities don't change, what happens, you tend to change the percentage of time that you devote to each of those based on whatever's going on in the organization. You know, one reporting period, let's say one survey, you might say, I do A 50% of the time, and next time it's B. That's real. You want to see how that work changes. But it's also interesting to see if the activities themselves change or how they vary from position to position. And we can do both. You can do both if you have the data. In fact, you expect the activity mixes to change over time. Some positions are very stable, some have changed very frequently.
And
So
Dean, there's a good opportunity here to talk about good, better, and best data. There's a question about taxonomies like APQC and then other data, so or in proxy data. So maybe you could go into that for just a minute
yeah,
and we can move
if
on.
you don't,
Thanks.
exactly. So we did mention, you know, the good, better, best idea at the conference. If you don't have this type of data, what can you use? Well, obviously, starting from scratch and building out a list. I would say building a taxonomy takes much more time. Building a list still takes time, but it's manageable. You can also look for third-party lists. You know, if you go to APQC, you can download their process framework. That's better than nothing. But it's not strictly activity-based data. It's built around processes. So, but it's a great place to start. If you don't have this and you want to do it, you're in a hole, right? You got to find some proxy that's better than you guessing. And that's not a bad way to do it. You know, there's a lot that goes into taxonomy building. And we, again, it's beyond the scope of this call. But I'm happy to discuss it with somebody if they ever want to talk about how we did ours. And basically, in our system, we do that for you, so you don't have to. But if you don't have it, you want to do it, look for proxies. Some things are better. You know, you could, depending on the level of granularity you want to get to, maybe you just want to go, instead of saying, I do all these keystrokes versus I do finance, maybe break it up in a way that people understand it, but it doesn't get too granular. What drives the level of granularity is what you're trying to report on. So in our system, for example, we have a host of reports and we want to get deep and we want to aggregate as well. So our taxonomy gets very granular. If you're not doing that, you might not have to get as granular as we do. You might be okay keeping it at like a work group level. This work group does this, this, and this. Maybe. It really depends on what you're trying to analyze.
Taking that back before we move on. Oh, sorry, before you go on, Jeremy, just to step back from that a minute with that good, better, best. Many of these decisions are made on judgment, right? I mean, it's a bunch, you know, you're whiteboarding or whatever, you know, so there's personal judgment. The opportunity here with the taxonomy and the activities is you can at least assign some confidence level. So you can add that to the decision making that you know, you have the judgment around where you think things need to go based on your experience, but you could also assign a, you know, 80% confidence level and 90% confidence level on whatever taxonomy your activities that you built. So one to make sure you have that factor in there as well.
And that's a good
Jeremy,
point. That
I think I cut off Jeremy. Sorry.
No, I
That's
just
fine.
wanted to
That's
give
a
Dean a
that,
15-minute warning.
yeah,
Okay.
I have a timer going. No, but that's a really good point because that kind of gets to the rationale of why it makes sense to track this data, to have a system that allows you to track work, to track activities. Doing it initially, yes, it takes time. And if you do it, don't throw it away. Systematize it in some way. All right, so what we want to do here in step five is now we want to actually see what happens if we remove work. Now, again, we're working at the activity level. We're dealing with activities and FTE. We're not talking about positions yet. There's two columns here, extreme, which I'm going to use, or conservative. And all that is saying, all right, how much work do we want to take out and model? In the real world, you would have several of these, and you wouldn't say we're going to take out all the work. What you do is break it into phases or waves. We automate one part of this value stream, then go to the next, and go to the next, then see what happened when you're all done. But this is a mathematical exercise, right? We're trying to build the case for it. We're not talking about implementation. We're not talking about a specific solution. So, for speed and clarity here, I'm going to say we're removing everything. And if we do that, this shows you how much FTE we take out and how much activity pay we're removing. And again, we can do that because the system is tracking the cost for every activity, right? And you can see that the impact is large. again, with not, without knowing anything else other than that, I think I'm going to take out 63 FTE. I know it's going to be a big impact. When you compare it to the $1.8 million implementation fees for year one, our net benefit is over $2.3 million with a payback in less than half a year. Year two and three, I didn't put in here. I didn't want to complicate it, but the annual benefit is about $1.5 million more. So it gets close to $4 million a year, which makes sense. That's what we're taking out. So the ROIs are huge. But this still isn't good enough to go back to your leadership team and say, we're ready to go. Directionally, it's beautiful. It's really compelling. Even in knowing that we probably got some error built in here, there's enough room to accommodate that error and still be positive in terms of the return. So that's the removal of work. We also have to think about what are we going to do with coordination? Again, we want to emphasize coordination. We want to make it a key feature of the organization for no other reason than to make sure we get the ROI we just modeled, right? How do we do that? How do we deal with roles after we've broken everything down to activities? Again, I say it's a relatively simple exercise because what you're doing is you're bundling activities into what you think are jobs and then doing the math associated with that. So this, if you look at the table on the left, the total FTE don't worry about what the activities actually do. Just look at the codes associated with, you can see some are associated with finance and some are associated with supply chain. And you see how much FTE we have to accommodate. At this size, you could do this in a spreadsheet. You can start assigning FTE by mix, by job, and then saying, okay, I need 10 of these or 8 of these or 5 of these, and check your math. Do you account for everything? If you look at the jobs that we created, there are three new jobs here. And you know, I just named them coordinators so they would stick with what we're trying to communicate here. But there's a couple of key points that comes out of this. First of all, no one reports their time to 0.29 increments. It just doesn't happen. They say, yep, I do this about 15% of the time or 20 or even 30. But what we're trying to prove here is that there's some combination of these activities that satisfy the FTE required. That means the work can get done and we can attribute a cost to it. But also notice that we bundled the work in these jobs so that it's much more narrow. You know, the environment that we pulled all this work from before previously, or the current state, that work is spread across multiple jobs. There's a lot of cross-domain bundling of those activities in there. Well, here in our fulfillment coordinator, all the activities are linked back to supply chain. It's a narrowly defined role focused on coordination. Same on the other end, where we've got AR coordinator, right? They're doing nothing but finance activities. And they're only doing three activities, which is a relatively low number. So it suggests, at least on paper, that we can really get some coordination here and we know what it's going to look like. The position cost is just the cost of that job based strictly on the cost of the activities. We originally thought of this of calling it like estimated pay, and it isn't because there's a difference. Gina, for example, might be a perfect candidate for one of these roles. But it turns out that there's a high demand. Whatever we end up designing, there's a similar position out in the wild, and it's in high demand. So it drives up what we're going to have to pay for that. Or Gina, being in the organization, has it, her loaded pay is already higher than that. That delta is explained, that premium is explained by a number of conditions. And this just helps us recognize it. We're not going to show it here, but in our system, you can look at, you know, what does someone actually pay? What's the value of that work, of that position, and what's the activity cost associated with that position? Just good data points. It's not to say that you shouldn't have a premium, they exist, but that's all we're picking up here is the cost for that. Now, this becomes really challenging if you don't have a system to do that on any large scale of activities and FTE. The number of permutations you could run through is close to infinite. We're working on a model right now. It's beta, where you can take a load of FTE activities, dump it in, answer some questions about rules, and come up with a solution set. Okay, so we've addressed taking work out. We've addressed the coordination. What do we do about our non-OTC work? We assumed that for simplicity, that it gets absorbed in existing roles in the organization. But there's a couple of options you have. That means it can get absorbed into our existing job and position number. There's enough slack in those jobs where people can do it. Or the jobs exist, but they're all full. In fact, maybe they're even closer to strain where they don't have any more capacity. Okay, we might have to add a few jobs here. We didn't even think about, is there any of this work that should go in our coordinator roles to make them a little better? We're assuming no, we want our coordination work to be focused, so we're not adding any of this other stuff. But just know that if none of these solutions work, you might have to design new roles using this same process. The key point, though, is what you absolutely cannot do is not allocate it somewhere. This is work that existed, it was performed. If you don't do it, things are going to go poorly. The last thing we have to do is say, okay, it's great. We can figure out cost removal by FTE and activity, but our leadership team wants to know positions. Well, we can take our data, use the average loaded pay for positions in the OTC population, and determine from there how many positions could we remove. And you see the numbers here between 45 and 56. So if I look at the extreme case, my data indicates that there's 63 FTE, maybe 56 positions that I could get rid of. And the chart on the right just shows you the impact between current state and future state. Now, are we in a strong enough position to go back to the leadership team? And I would say, no. I think we have to do this remaining work. The data that you've seen so far is directional. You need to take it down to the level where you're using specific positions and specific names. So, for example, we know we're going to take a lot of roles out. We have a bunch of people. Are we going to term them all? Or are we going to put them elsewhere in the organization? Are we going to use them in these new roles? If I'm taking a case I just used earlier, the example, Gina has a higher loaded pay than the 74,000 we used for an average. As we plug that into our model, that changes our ROI, and that's okay. It's more, you'd much rather have specificity in your ROI and a lower value than some variables you can't explain and this tremendous ROI. We also assumed that we were getting rid of all these positions, and that might not be the case. It might be that we automate and that frees up people and resources that we can deploy or reinvest elsewhere. If that would weaken your ROI, but it might strengthen your business case. So, for example, in the business case, we say we're gonna automate order to cash, and with the people that are removed from those 63 positions and the dollars, some combination of that, we're gonna reinvest in sales and R&D or something like that. Your ROI is less, but your business case becomes much better, right? We're bringing automation and improvement to one area of the business, and we've got savings that we can apply elsewhere. I'll run through these last three very quickly. The job architecture needs to be addressed. Even though we're only adding three new positions, they might not fit into the job groups that you currently have. And these are not spec jobs by any stretch of the imagination. They talk about the activities they perform. HR would still have to put these in the correct job level, right? Assign all types of stuff to this. Are they independent contributors, or do they have managerial responsibility? Everything that goes into that feeds into the job architecture, and you have to do this accurately. If you're in a company that uses job architecture for really strong categorization and data analysis, otherwise you break that. And lastly, we've got to figure out how we do this. So the question initially was, can we automate? Well, we're past that now. We want to say, sure, we can. The question is now, how do we structure post-automation? What do we do with this bundle of work that we've automated? Does it live in shared services? Is it distributed throughout the organization? How do our, 22 coordinator roles function? Are they a cross-cutting team so they can see everywhere? Do they have any authorities over roles in finance, for example? All that has to be figured out. And to do that, you have to get down to the actual position name level, but it helps us do it. And then lastly, there's monitoring. The framework that we just described is a great way for you to also do monitoring down the road. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of people keeping an eye on the technology, but how are we evaluating these new roles that we put in? Did we overspec or underspec? Are the assignments of activities correct? You want to monitor all of that, just like you do in any other implementation, but you should expect that there's going to be some tweaks down the road. Okay. I rushed that last bit, but
That's
I
okay.
wanted to get there
Yeah.
just to give us a few
You
seconds here.
did. We got a few minutes. I wanted to put an exclamation point on that monitoring because there were a number of questions around what if the activities change, the transformation. That monitoring, it, running all these tests again tells you that maybe the activities change. You know, when you get different results, then that would give you a cue that that is what to look at. So I want to put an exclamation
Correct.
point on that part
Correct.
for it.
And I think, let's say, because you want to do this, let's say you survey these roles or the people in these roles monthly. So you can actually see how the activity load changes on a month-to-month basis. That's instrumental or just invaluable data on your ultimate job design and where you think you're going to end. Think of it this way too. With that amount of automation, we didn't take anything out of coordination. Did we overspec? You could make the argument that there's probably some savings to be had in coordination too, because we'd have less errors to deal with as our coordinator roles assume that. Anyway, there's that monitoring and using this framework is important.
Let me do one closing statement. We'll open it up, and Dean and I will stay on for a few minutes if you have other
Sure.
questions. Reminder, this session was recorded and will be sent to everyone who signed up along with a copy of the content. The next ODXT session in this series is November 10th with AlignOrg, and always check our calendar. We have events almost every week, and I'd encourage everybody in the U.S. as well as outside to connect to our partner organization, EODF, which is eodf.eu, because they have events that you'll find interesting as well. Okay, we'll
Yeah, and I
stop.
would just say, here's our email, get in touch with Jeremy and I, connect on
That's the next thing.
LinkedIn.
Yeah, the
Happy to
contact
talk about this.
information is in there, and that will also be in the email that comes out. So at this point, we'll just open it up for any questions. And like I said, Dean and I will stay on a little bit longer if you'd like us to. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thank you.
Your presentation was so good, Dean. Nobody has any questions. They're
That's
all
impossible.
they're all going to
So
take
here's what
these
will happen.
pictures and go back to their
Yeah.
executives and
If you if something pops into your head, let's say it's tomorrow and you think, oh, that was nagging me or something, send us a note. I'm happy to hop on a call or send an email and tell you what I think.
We have, I forgot to say, we have a survey as well, so I'll share that with you if there's any other questions. But Jeremy, to your very good point, Dean has been through this, what, 27 times now, Dean, with the ODF presentation.
Oh yeah, at least,
So
right?
yeah, it has, it not surprisingly, it's more polished.
Well, if you can only remember one thing, the power of measuring work at the activity level, in my opinion, is unsurpassed. There's no other, I think, organizational or work type data point that works better than that. It's just, again, I'm such a big believer. We built a company around it. And then don't discard it. If you start going down this path, which I think you should, systematize it if you can.
Who we have left? One, two, three of us, and then Graham and Roman. They may have walked away. There's just two other ones, so we probably can call it a day.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, there's that. So yeah, so this is going out too, and then it's in the chat. So and then we'll get, like I said, whatever survey data we get, I'll share that as well. Nice to see you again, Jeremy.
Nice to see you again.
And Dean, I
Okay.
guess until next time.
Yes. Well, as always, I enjoy working with you, Gina.
I enjoy working with you too. Thanks very much.
Okay.
We will,
All
okay, there, that's it. Now everybody's gone. All right, perfect. Talk to you later.
right. Have a great
Bye.
day. Jeremy, I'm going to give you a call.